Hello and welcome to the official Nightfall podcast. My name's Dan Jones. I'm a historian and the official historical consultant to season one of Nightfall. Now, before we get going, I have to remind you that this episode of the podcast contains spoilers, up to and including episode 8 of Nightfall season 1. I don't want you to stop listening, but equally, I don't want you to complain that I've ruined the show for you. So if you aren't up to date on the TV show, maybe have a listen to something else. History's Vikings podcast, I hear, is very good. And come back here when you've caught up. Now, in this episode, I'll be talking to Julian Ovendon and Sabrina Bartlett. That's William de Nogaret and Princess Isabella to you. We'll be talking about their characters and the relationship between them. Ed Stoppard, that's Philip IV, will also be stopping by. We love Ed, so why not? But first, let's recap everything that just happened in episode 8. Now, where do we start? Well, how about in Navarre, where Queen Joan has gone on a sort of royal gap year to try and sort things out with her cousin, Elena.
Cousin Joan.
Who's still sulking about her son, Louis, being blown up in that quite unfortunate incident with the Greek fire and the Mongol assassin. And you just kind of think, when is she going to get over this? Well, not in this episode. Elena put Joan under siege, and her demands are absolutely outrageous.
I will have your capitulation, but I want something else too. Restitution.
Wait, capitulation and restitution? Most people can't even spell restitution, Elena. Give it up.
If it's capitulation, you're going to be disappointed.
Seriously, it's quite hard to spell. I always put an extra T in it. Anyway, Joan's not big on restitution either, but that's her bad luck, because she gets betrayed by Governor de Rouvray and banged up under house arrest at Elena's pleasure.
King's orders, no bloodshed.
Back in the temple, Landry's home, and he has some big news for his brothers.
It has been 15 years since we lost Acca.
Oh my God, Landry, are you ever going to stop going on about that?
For 15 years since we lost
but
this...
But actually, that's not his news. In fact, he's come home with the Holy Grail, which you'll remember he found up a orange tree in a box. Well, orange tree or no orange tree, the Templars in Paris, they absolutely love it. But of course, it's not all good news, because as Landry tells Draper, Gawain has gone rogue.
Gawain!
You can't soft soap it. It is a real bummer. And I think Draper sums up exactly what we've all been thinking.
Dear God, I can't believe it.
Now, of course, when you find the Holy Grail up an orange tree, there's only one person you should call, and that's His Holiness Pope Boniface VIII, who's been banging on and on about the Grail ever since he first appeared in episode 2. Being a good Templar master, or possibly a classic tragic hero regularly railroaded into predictable mistakes by his complex interior dialectic between his own instinctive moral probity and his lifelong conditioning to adhere to the structural demands of organised religion, I'm going to leave that one up to you. Landry is actually going to give the Grail to the Pope. The question is, what's Boniface going to do with it?
What will you do now?
Well, first of all, he wouldn't be the Pope if he didn't say some Latin.
Benedictio Dei Omnipotentis.
Thanks, Boniface. But more to the point, he's going to use the Grail to launch a new crusade and unite all of Europe into a superstate, which to me actually sounds a bit like the European Union if it were ruled over by Billy Graham, kind of with a sort of shiny Rasta hat on his head.
God will be reborn.
Is Landry going to put up with this? No, of course he's not. Because just in the nick of time, he works out that the mysterious letter-writing IV, who brought Parsifal to his death, is Roland. And that means Roland has been working for the Pope.
Now I understand why.
So let's be clear about that. That's Roland, Godfrey's killer, working for the Pope, Billy Graham in a Rasta hat. Draper, tell it like it is.
Dear God, I can't believe it.
Now, unfortunately for Landry, the Pope gets away with the Grail, which leaves Landry, Rashid and Anna stuck in the temple with Pierre and a bunch of papal bad boys running about on the roof like the aliens in the movie Aliens. But Landry wants to bust out and fight them, obviously, but Anna tells him he's not allowed.
There are too many of them.
Now, think about that. Landry's mum has literally told him he can't go out to play. If I know Landry, he's only going to react in one way. Ah! Wow, I mean, that's probably my favourite Landry roar so far. Anyway, it turns out Landry is going to fight after all because the aliens, sorry, the papal goons on the roof chuck quicklime down the chimneys onto the fireplaces.
That is quicklime!
Now, while all this is going on, back at the palace, our favourite death-defying atheist, Dinogre, is back.
God!
And he's dropping some non-quicklime-containing truth bombs all over King Philip's lap. Non-quicklime-containing truth bomb one. The Grail is in France. Non-quicklime-containing truth bomb 2, Landry de Lauzon has been getting busy with the Queen.
Sleeping with your wife.
Does Philip have anything to say about that? Nothing?
I can't believe it.
Well, at least someone's on the ball. Speaking of Joan, down in Navarre, things are getting pretty tasty. And by tasty, I mean Joan and Elena have had a bit of a cry together, and then Joan stabbed Elena through the guts. Which is a happy ending for everyone except for Elena. So all that's left to tie up in this episode is what's going to happen to Landry and co. back at the temple. And the answer is a whole lot of sweet slaying. There's a big fight in the courtyard in which the papal guards kill Rashid, Landry kills Pierre, and Anna shows that even glassy-eyed mums in sackcloth who don't like their little boys going out fighting can use a crossbow if they have to. And finally, to top it all off, during the battle, the Templars get some help from an old friend on the roof.
You'd think he would die.
Step forward, mysterious but strangely familiar bloke in Brotherhood of Light costume. Drum roll, please. Drum roll? Oh, we don't have a drum roll. Right, I'll just tell you. It's Tancred!
Tancred.
He's not dead! He's back!
Master.
And you know as well as I do, there's only one thing to say about that.
I can't believe it.
Let's get on with the show. First of all, when I was talking to director Douglas MacKinnon, who appeared on last week's episode, I asked him if he had hidden any Easter eggs in the show. And by that I mean little cryptic hints and in-jokes that viewers have to work out for themselves. And when we were talking, he was pretty coy about it. Let's hear what he had to say.
You know, there's things hidden all over the place that we'd like to think that people will enjoy looking for and enjoy finding out about.
But just because Douglas isn't telling, I don't think that means we should give up looking. And when I was watching back episode 8 this week, I spotted what I thought was a pretty great one. It's close to the top of the show when Pierre is hiding Parsifal's body in Godfrey's tomb. Now, if you think back to this scene, we see quite a lingering shot of the Templar cemetery where Godfrey's buried from above. The first look we get of it shows Godfrey's tomb, where his body is lying in quite an unusual position. Now, clearly it's not in a coffin, but I think that's deliberate because it lets us see that, firstly, we're looking at Godfrey, and secondly, that his legs are crossed, kind of like he's desperate to go and pee. But as we all know, the dead don't pee. So what's going on? Well, I think the riddle's answered the next time we see that same top shot, because on the grave, next to Godfrey's, there's an effigy in stone of another knight, and he's lying in exactly the same position. His legs are crossed. In this case, he's also, quite distinctively, got his feet resting on what looks like a dragon or possibly a devil. Now, as soon as I saw that in this episode, it rang a bell, because I'd seen that tomb effigy somewhere before. It's actually a pretty direct copy of a real tomb effigy, belonging to William Marshall, the second Earl of Pembroke, who was a knight and nobleman who lived in England during the 13th century, about half a century before the events taking place in Nightfall unfold. Now, this William Marshall was the son of an elder William Marshall, the first Earl of Pembroke, and he was a friend and a loyal retainer of a whole string of medieval England's Plantagenet kings, including Henry II and his three sons, Henry the Young King, Richard the Lionheart, and Bad King John. And the elder William Marshall has the reputation as the greatest knight who ever lived. That William was a crusader. He went to Jerusalem to fulfill a vow on behalf of Henry the Young King, and on his deathbed in 1219, he revealed that he'd secretly taken Templar vows. And it looks to me like his tomb has been copied, as well as his son's, and placed in Godfrey's graveyard. Now, there's a very good reason for all this, which is that William Marshall the father and William Marshall the son both have their real tombs in one of the most famous Templar locations in the world, Not talking about Oak Island, I mean the Temple Church in central London, one time headquarters of the English branch of the Templars. Now, you could blink during episode 8 of Nightfall and you'd miss all of that. After all, what we're really interested in seeing is Parsifal getting chucked down on top of Godfrey, whose murder he avenged. But for real Templar aficionados, I think this is a little wink from Douglas MacKinnon and the set design team, reminding us that we need to stay on our toes. Now, William de Nogaret was one of the leading henchmen of the real-life King Philip IV of France. He was a lawyer of fairly lowly birth, originally from the south of France, and possibly with family links to a group of heretics known as the Cathars, hence Malraux. Was he an atheist, as we see him in Nightfall? Well, probably not. But as history would prove, he was certainly a deadly opponent of both Pope Boniface VIII and of the Templars. So let's hear more about William de Nogaret from the man who plays him.
Hello.
Julian.
Yes.
It's Dan Jones. Here's Julian Ovenden.
So you saw his motives, that he wasn't a psychopath, he wasn't a sociopath. There was a lot that was, you know, sort of human and understandable about him.
Do you see him in that sense? I'm, as you're speaking now, I'm thinking of the way that, say, Thomas Cromwell was portrayed in Wolf Hall, you know, not yeah. necessarily as a character of good or of evil, but just of pragmatism and of dealing and of practicality in some senses.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, he deals in efficiency and pragmatism and rationale. You know, there's a wonderful scene towards the end of the show where he actually sees he gets his hands on the Grail. And he's incredibly disappointed. He's incredibly sort of underwhelmed by it. and he compares it to, you know, the great achievements of man in terms of literature and jurisprudence and architecture and, you know, painting, all the rest of it, music, and that's where, you know, he's interested in things that he can see and understand, and he seems very modern and aware and conscious of the world, rather than being blinded by religious, craziness.
I was rapt listening to you because I think it's one of the things that I found that Nightfall does that at first seems counterintuitive, but actually, in my experience, is borne out somewhat by the evidence, is place into this world characters who buy in to a lesser degree into the religious framework of the world than others. And I think we're always so surprised to see this, you know, in an early modern or medieval context, because one just assumes everyone was exact to the more or less the same degree religious, and that was that. And I think what's interesting, particularly with your character de Nogaret, is that, as you say, he is virtually an atheist, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he has...
I would say so. I mean, I think, you know, he has to sort of appear to sort of follow some sort of adherence to, you know, the Catholic Church. I mean, there are scenes in chapels and things with the king. You know, he's not going out of his way to denounce... You know, Catholicism, but he has a very open disdain for it. And the scenes with the Pope in season one are wonderful because they both know exactly where the other stands. Mm. And there's, in a way, a mutual respect. I mean, I sort of treated him as a sort of anti-hero of the show, in a way. I found the struggle that he goes through is sort of, in a way, quite noble is perhaps not the right word, but you know, I sort of appreciated what he was able to do.
And in a way you sympathize
in some sense with what he does.
One of the most important relationships in Nightfall is between King Philip and his advisor, Denogare. So before we hear more from Julian, here's Ed Stoppard, who plays King Philip, on the phone with his take.
He is really quite reliant on him. I mean, this is one of the things... I mean, I know, you know, kings have advisors and whatnot and dum-de-dum, but it felt like that relationship is really critical for Philip. And, you know, he's under no illusions as to, you know, the kind of darkness at the heart of Denogare's personality, should we say. And, you know, is perfectly willing for Denogare to get his hands dirty on Philip's behalf. But I think he really does lean on him. I mean, that's one of the aspects of his character, which I thought, okay, this is kind of interesting. This is sort of, you know, this is worth exploring, which was sort of, you know, his kind of ability to vacillate, this Philip, I mean. And, you know, that gives Denogare opportunities to sort of insinuate himself and, you know, to influence Philip's thinking and influence Philip's behavior. And I think, you know, Philip, he kind of does swing between wanting to be this sort of decisive, potent monarch and, you know, being this sort of conflicted individual. And I mean, maybe this is a moment late in the day where I can bring in the character of his grandfather, Louis, who was made a saint during Philip's lifetime, I think, St. Louis. And he, you know, he was this revered figure, who, you know, known for his kind of devout aesthetic, well, maybe aesthetic's too strong a word, but certainly devout ways, and, you know, obviously some miracles were attributed to him, and Philip looked to emulate Louis. And during my research, that was something which I thought, oh, that's kind of good, that's interesting, that he's aspiring to follow in the footsteps of this man, his grandfather. And, you know, I think there's a kind of bit of a, it felt to me there was a bit of a push and pull between you know, the man that Philip hoped himself to be, and maybe the man he was in reality.
So I think what Ed's saying there is that King Philip's ambition to be like his grandfather, King Louis IX, is the very thing that Denogare plays off. So here's Julian again on the king and his advisor.
They are from, you know, completely, you know, the other end of the spectrum from each other. It's interesting. You know, it's interesting what I found really pleasing with, you know, it was really fun to do the scenes with Ed, you know, partly because he's a really good actor. But also because, again, like the relationship with Isabella, it's not necessarily all one-way traffic. I'm not always leading him to make a decision. I'm guiding him, but guiding him really, you know, I have to be quite soft in the way that I do it. You know, sort of just gently planting seeds. And he's quite good at, you know, he's a master manipulation. He knows how Philip works. He plays to his vanity. He plays to his, you know, masculinity. Philip wants to be the strong, you know, omnipotent ruler. And he's not that kind of king, I think. Well, he isn't that kind of king at the start, anyway. he definitely turns towards the end of season one. And I think that also poses interesting questions for season two as to how much, you know, how I can, you know, deal with someone whose character has sort of slightly transformed and probably gained more power, more self-awareness. But yeah, the scenes, the sort of relationship is a really interesting one, and they're codependent, I suppose, aren't they? They can't exist without each other. Philip, you know, if he didn't have me, he would be very vulnerable, I think. And even if, you know, obviously I need the king, I need the king's ear.
Aside from his relationship with the king, de Nogaret's infatuation with Princess Isabella is one of the main driving forces behind the story in Nightfall. So I asked Julian whether he sees de Nogaret as just the creepy uncle, or if there's a lot more to it.
I didn't want that sort of feeling. You know, he's sort of leading her through making decisions, and he's excited by the power that she has, or, you know, the potential is a better word, the potential that she has in terms of the decision, you know, the decision she makes as to who she's going to marry, for example, is a massive one. And, you know, in terms of how that creates more advantages for France. On the global stage or the European stage. And so it was quite interesting to sort of, over the course of 10 episodes, because there's quite a lot of up and down in their relationship, to kind of not necessarily answer too many of those questions, to sort of leave them open-ended and see what happened. But I definitely didn't want to make him creepy sort of pervy uncle, but I also didn't want to make him, you know, sort of too parental. The relationship with, for example, the relationship with Henry Higgins and Eliza Doolittle in Pygmalion, or, you know, later in My Fair Lady, is an interesting parallel. The relationship is sort of, you know, kind of half didactic and half romantic. It's a strange. You know, it exists in a strange world. So, I mean, I'm kind of interested to know sort of how that develops in the next, you know, bunch of episodes. But it certainly gives him a vulnerability and a different colours with which to play, which is, you know, because he's usually so in control. And with Isabella, he's not.
Now, for me, Princess Isabella is one of the most extraordinary characters from the 14th century, in fact, from the whole of the Middle Ages. In Nightfall, we meet her as a teenager, but she would grow up, in history, to be a formidable queen. She married not Louis of Catalonia, obviously, but Edward II, King of England. Now, this definitely wasn't a happy marriage, but instead of taking it lying down, Isabella abandoned her husband, fled to France with her lover, raised an army, invaded England, kicked her husband off the throne, and had him murdered. Later legend said that was done with a red-hot poker placed somewhere quite unpleasant. So what we're seeing in Nightfall is, well, it's bad, but it's hardly out of character. I kicked off my conversation with Sabrina Bartlett, who plays Isabella, by asking her where she started with her research into the character.
Well, I mean, the history was actually pretty intimidating to be faced with, you know, to read about the extraordinary things that she did and to start to understand the sort of queen she was in terms of the impact she had politically, both in France from a young age and, you know, as well as when she came to rule England. I was thinking, you know, God, how do I approach this figure? How do I portray this iconic queen? So I just thought I would look at her as a human being, which was, you know, the 16-year-old teenager whose reality is being Princess of France. So, you know, looking at the heartbeat of the person and, you know, the equivalent being your mum and dad take away your iPhone and you're not allowed to text the boy you fancy. So, you know, you rebel and you wear loads of eyeliner and go out late at night to piss them off. And
then get involved in a plot to blow him up in a chariot.
Yes, exactly.
Normal 16-year-old stuff.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it sounds like you had a sense of who this person was before you took on the role.
Absolutely. I mean, God, there's so many frames of reference to look at. I mean, there's been some wonderful books written about her. There's been amazing films. I mean, there's a wealth of knowledge, which I think is very luxurious to have as an actor, because often or not, you're it's very rare to have a character that's actually lived, that you can actually draw from, inspiring the choices you make when you're creating a person, either on screen or in theatre. So to have such a wealth of information was an absolute luxury, and also so enjoyable, because, you know, you can go to Waterstones in central London and you only need to speak of Isabella of France, and you've got numerous novels, you've got all these references. And, you know, it was intimidating, though, because there's just so much to draw from with her. And, you know, you want to do her the respect of getting it right. You want to, you want this character to be believable, but you want to also stand up to how history represents her as well. You know, do her justice.
So in the show, we meet in Nightfall. We meet Isabella, aged as you mentioned. A little earlier, in her sort of mid to late teens, 15, 16, kind of sexually awakening, devious, kicking back against her parents. Historically, at this point, she was a little younger. You know, she's probably about sort of
12,
yeah, sort of at the end of childhood at this point. Do you think that decision by the writers to advance her age by a few years was helpful within the realm of the show? I mean, it gives her more to do, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think in terms of the relationship with Dino Gray, I think it is seeing her at 16, I think, is more of a relatable age in terms of sexual curiosity starting to awaken in most girls of that age. That is the kind of age where you are figuring out your sexuality as a woman and you're starting to feel these shifts going on. And in terms of interpreting that on screen for people to watch, I think that age felt like such a ripe age to explore that with the character. And also as a actor, 16 felt like such a, I feel like it's such a exciting, but also it's a crazy age for women.
It's a really interesting dynamic that's going on there. It's not a simple sort of dirty uncle, flirty sort of niece, you know, quote unquote,
no,
uncle and niece at all, is it? It's much deeper than that. Tell us a bit more about that arc in the show.
Well, I mean, for starters, it was one of the main things that attracted me to the show and playing the character, because I just think such a almost uncomfortable and controversial subject matter in that relationship is something that I don't think is often explored in TV and film. It's quite taboo to see that, you know, that sort of relationship. And like you say, it goes a lot deeper than the surface value, like you say, the flirty uncle and the young girl. And I actually read the novel Lolita in preparation for that relationship, because I thought it was so useful in drawing from such a controversial relationship there with Humbert and Dolores. I really feel like that's such a mirror in the conflict of Isabella and Dino Gray, because there is so much trust there. He's grown up with the family. He's been very much part of her life. And if you notice it so far, Isabella has always gone to Dino Gray when she feels vulnerable. Mm. He's her confidant. You know, there's a level of respect for each other, as well as there's a confessional tone to their relationship. She really shows him those vulnerable sides of herself. She exposes something. And also, I think for him, that there's so much care for her. He so badly wants her to succeed in her, you know, to become an amazing queen. He so badly wants her to fulfill her potential. So, you know, I think there is a lot of love there. It's not just this sexual, there is a lot of, obviously there's this amazing sexual current that they have between them. But I think, like you say, it goes a lot deeper than that. It's a very complex relationship.
Do you think it's easier for the writers, and in a sense also for the viewers, to explore a relationship like that in the setting of the Middle Ages, when, you know, age of consent, age of marriage, age of accepted sexual awakening was younger than it is today. You know, whatever we think yes. about that, it's the case that girls were often married by 12 and sometimes younger in the Middle Ages, and that, that this whole area, which we instinctively and you know, rightly, we should say, shrink from today, is somehow you've got more room to explore it when you're telling a story about the Middle Ages.
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because with this time, the lifespan was shorter. You know, the stakes were a lot higher. That everybody, you know, it's quite blunt to say this, but everybody died at such an earlier age. There wasn't the medicine that we have today. So the stakes of achieving one's goals in life, and they loved harder. They lived harder. Everything was on such a higher stakes in achievement. So in Isabella's reign, I think that's why de Nogre has this urge of wanting her to fulfill her potential. And Isabella also has that in terms of her love for the prince. You know, she's so ambitious for the crown, and she lives and breathes her preparation to become queen. But also she's so desperate to have it there and then, and to have her love, to have her prince and her marriage, you know, that everything had a quicker expiration date of everything happening, I think, which is interesting in medieval times.
Do you think we also see with it, with regard to the particular plot line, you know, the Isabella Catalonia plot line, obviously that's fictionalized for Nightfall, but what we know from history is that Isabella certainly in her adult life didn't shy away from, you know, controversial and even murderous involvement in politics,
yes.
right? You know, and she spoiler alert for the whole of it, medieval history, but she grows up, she becomes this incredibly powerful queen who deposes her husband, Edward II of England, and in concert with her lover has him murdered. Are we seeing the beginnings of that sort of historical arc in season one of Nightfall?
Absolutely. I think I like to describe her as, you know, how the moon has an eclipse. So the moon is very pure and white and round. And then when the eclipse starts, you start to see the darker side overtaking the purity of the moon as a whole. And I think that's what I would describe Isabella's arc. You know, she has this amazing transformation of darkness. But I do think what's important, it comes from a very human place, which is the humiliation of the purity test, which was done in order to secure the line of succession and to ensure the child was, you know, is a legitimate heir of Louise. And I think the humiliation, the trauma of that having happened to her is what shapes her seeking revenge, and her, you know, horrifying experience is what I think ultimately it is what shapes the treachery that follows in terms of the cruelty of what happens to Louise in that episode. It's the wrath of humiliation. It's the betrayal, the pain of what she believes he has done to her. But that's only going to be, you know, what we go on to see when the person that she goes to when she's most vulnerable, her most trusted confidant, turns out to be the person of all that undoing, you know, de Nogre, and the peephole discovering that he's been spying on her, that this element of possession that he has over her is ultimately what leads to, you know, such an awful condemning of his life, you know, which we see in the next episode.
Okay, so there's one other thing that grabbed my attention in this episode, besides all the stabbing, fighting, roaring, and quicklime getting chucked down the chimney. And that's something that the Pope says when he's talking to Landry about the Grail. Let's hear him.
Et benedictio Dei omnipotentis, patris et filii, spiritus sancti.
Yeah, very funny. No, I mean the bit where Boniface tells Landry that he wants to use the Grail to rally a new crusade.
I will launch a fresh crusade. What better symbol to lead us back to the Holy Land?
And he's not the only one thinking like that. So, is this just Grail legend mischief-making by the Nightfall writers? Well, not entirely, or maybe not at all. Because actually, the year 1306, which is when the events in Nightfall are supposedly set, was quite a big year in the whole field of crusade suggesting. As we saw in the very first episode of Nightfall, the crusader states in the Holy Land had fallen in 1291, with the city of Acre and a few Templar castles providing the last stand in the Holy Land. We know now that, as it turned out, they were never to be regained. But just because we know the Crusader states were historically never coming back, that doesn't mean that people at the time knew that. In fact, Crusade planning went on right up until the 15th and even the 16th centuries. So far from people in the Middle Ages thinking that 1291 was somehow the end, in some ways, the disasters of that year had injected quite a lot of energy into the whole let's get Jerusalem back movement, which had been on the wane for most of the 13th century. Okay, so weighed against all of that is the obvious fact that in 1306, the real Boniface VIII was not charging around Paris hunting for cups and spouting things in Latin. He was, in fact, dead. But the real Pope of the day, Clement V, took a very clear interest in crusading. His namesake, Clement IV, had been a key sponsor of the last really big crusade, led by Philip IV's grandfather in the mid-13th century. So Clement V, that's the Pope in 1306, was desperately casting about for someone to give him a good idea of how to launch the next crusade. Now, to that end, early in 1306, the Pope sent letters to Cyprus, which was where the Templar Grand Master Jacques de Molay was hanging out, telling him to get back to France and come up with a plan for how a new crusade could work. Jacques de Molay was also asked to defend the Templars against suggestions that the order should be rolled up with the Hospitallers, but I kind of don't want to get into that in this episode. What's important now is that de Molay and Clement, i.e. the Templars and the Pope, were both in 1306 doing a ton of work on strategies for retaking Jerusalem and the Holy Land. De Molay's idea, which he presented to Clement in 1307, was pretty simple. He was in favour of a massive surge of troops, at least 15,000 knights, sent east on huge troop carrier ships to invade the eastern Mediterranean, possibly joining up with the Mongols to smash the Mamluks in a decisive field battle. Now, in reality, all of that would have been massively impractical and completely unaffordable. And in the end, de Molay's plans came to nothing because Philip IV and the Pope both got involved in taking down the Templars instead of listening to de Molay's half-baked ideas for a crusading mega-surge. But the big point is still important in terms of what the Nightfall writers are trying to do with Boniface in this episode, as well as illustrating the fact that people were still talking about a major crusade in 1306. Because the point is that in their minds, the war, the crusades, weren't over. In fact, if anything, they were overdue a new round of hostilities. Isn't that right, Landry?
It has been 15 years since we lost Acre.
Maybe if the real Templars had had the Grail in 1306, everything would have been different. And with that, it's time to bring this episode of the podcast to a close. But what's coming up next time? Well, we'll be speaking to Simon Merrells. Let's see if he's got another dice with death to tell us about. And we'll be talking about his fight scene with a returning guest. But you'll have to wait until next time to find out more. Thanks for listening. History's Nightfall podcast is presented by Dan Jones and produced by Sam Pearson for A&E Networks.